Good morning. The open meeting for the Federal Election Commission for May 16th, 2024 will come to order. We have three items on our agenda today. First item we're going to discuss is a proposed directive concerning request to withhold, redact, or modify contributors identifying information, a memorandum from Commissioner Dickerson. So to get us—
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, please. There's a special motion, isn't there? Thank you very much. It's been a while since we've had one of those. Let me turn it over to the Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the commission consider eligibility report, Mike Pence for president, and Mike Pence and Mike Pence for president, date of ineligibility, LRA 1194, and that the commission determine pursuant to 11 CFR section 2.7D1 that business so requires and no earlier public announcement was possible. I further move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order that the commission may consider the late submission of agenda document number 24-21-A.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair. All of those in favor of the Vice Chair's motion say aye.
Aye.
All right, that motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much, Vice Chair. Thank you very much to the Secretary's Office for the correction. Now, turning back to the proposed directive concerning requests to withhold, redact, or modify contributors identifying information, let me turn it over to Commissioner Dickerson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Let me begin by thanking the public for its engagement with this proposal. There were several substantive comments that were filed, including one from a United States Senator. I'm grateful for those efforts, and I hope that commentators will continue to engage with the Commission as we work to craft a regulation on this important topic. I also want to thank my colleagues and Commission staff. What appears to be a single Commissioner's proposal, in fact, represents numerous conversations among Commissioners and the hard work of dedicated civil servants. I appreciate those efforts as well. Today is the beginning of a long overdue discussion. The disclosure requirements of the Federal Election Campaign Act serve an important role, but they are not absolute. From the beginning, the Supreme Court has explained that, at least in some circumstances, compelled disclosure poses an undue risk that Americans will experience threats, harassment, or reprisals because of their political associations. Now, fair-minded people disagree on precisely where to draw the line, but that's precisely why the formality and rigor of a regulation is required. The Commission should have taken that step 48 years ago, when the Supreme Court first explained that at least certain individuals and certain organizations must be exempted from our disclosure regime. We will, I hope, take that step today. Before voting, I'd like to make three points. First, we should be honest about the scope of the public reporting this agency demands. Every individual who gives more than $200 must disclose his or her name, address, employer, and occupation. That was one thing in 1976, when $200 was worth more than $1,000 now, and when our records were only available in hard copy at FEC headquarters. Now that information is available to anyone, instantly and forever, on the internet. Worse, we have interpreted the law to require the disclosure of even the tiniest contribution if it is made through fundraising platforms like ActBlue and WinRed, platforms that raise billions of dollars from millions of Americans, many of them contributing far below the $200 threshold Congress considered relevant. It is simply inaccurate and dishonest to suggest that the FEC's disclosure burdens fall mainly on the wealthy and the powerful. Second, we know the standard to apply, although reasonable people may disagree on how best to interpret it. The Supreme Court has explained that an as-applied exception to our rules is appropriate where an individual or group can demonstrate a reasonable probability that a particular compelled disclosure will subject them to threats, harassment, or reprisals from either government officials or private parties. Those are not the commission words. Those are not the words of the commission, nor are they mine. Those are from the Supreme Court itself, consistently over decades. Finally, we are already doing this. The commission has excused the disclosure of all contributors to a minor political party. It has redacted the personal addresses of contributors to a corporate PAC. Even in my comparatively short time here, on several occasions, and sometimes unanimously, we have permitted contributors to redact or replace their home addresses in official FEC reports. To be clear, I support those decisions. but ordinary Americans are entitled to the same consideration as the well-connected. It is time to formally address this longstanding issue and to publicly announce by regulation our procedures for granting as-applied exceptions to our reporting obligations. Until we do so, I propose a temporary directive to streamline our consideration of individual requests. Under that directive, no one can be relieved of any portion of our disclosure requirements unless a bipartisan majority of the commission believes they have adequately demonstrated the need. The directive merely provides a formal and temporary replacement for the commission's existing ad hoc process. I hope my colleagues will support this effort and take concrete steps to defend vulnerable Americans' ability to fully participate in this aspect of our political process. With that, Mr. Chairman, I thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Dickerson. Colleagues, Commissioner Litterbaum.
Thank you. I am unable to support the proposed directive, but I do support a formal rulemaking with a notice and comment period to determine if and how we should adopt the ideas in the proposed directive. But I'd like to take this opportunity to discuss a related disclosure issue. Ensuring transparency in the financing of elections is at the heart of what the Federal Election Commission does. The current disclosure rules require that political committees report the name, full mailing address, occupation, and employer of each individual who makes contributions that aggregate $200 or more each election cycle. However, popular online political contribution platforms like ActBlue and WinRed must disclose every contribution, including those as little as a dollar. I believe it's time for Congress to reconsider the need for the public disclosure of the street number and street name of contributors. Any benefit to the public knowing the exact address of a contributor is outweighed by the safety concerns of having a contributor's address easily accessible on the commission's website. Congress should maintain the requirement that political committees collect and report contributors' full mailing addresses to the commission, but only require that the commission publish the contributor's name, city, state, zip code, occupation, and employer. In the 1970s, when the Act was promulgated and the Commission was born, the accessibility of contributor information to the general public looked very different than it does now. Today, armed with only an individual's name, it takes less than half a dozen clicks on the Commission's website to find that a person's mailing address on a public disclosure report. By contrast, until relatively recently, someone would have to physically come down to the Commission's office and browse through paper filings for the same information. Some individuals, like major donors or celebrities, are already cautious about disclosing their home address and have access to sophisticated advisors that counsel them to disclose only a work address or other mailing address instead. However, most everyday Americans will not be aware that reporting their home address when making political contributions might subject them to security concerns until a future time, well after the relevant contributions were made and long after their personal information is already accessible on disclosure reports filed with the commission. It's unfortunately easy to envision such a scenario. Take, for example, a poll worker who has become subject to threats and harassment due to a video containing false allegations about their work. Their home address is easily located on the commission's website within minutes of the video's release, and they have to flee their home. Consider a victim of a domestic violence who retreats to the refuge of a childhood home or a family member's residence, only for their abuser to locate them by searching their parents' or other family members' names on the commission's website. Or in another modern example, a woman may not reveal her home address to a man she meets on a dating app, but he may nevertheless be able to access it via the commission's website. While hopefully rare, Congress needs to consider such scenarios and the possible risk to individuals' personal safety when requiring that the commission disclose contributor street addresses. The two-tiered approach I propose is not unprecedented. Both California and Texas maintain similar reporting and disclosure regimes. Like the Act, both states' laws require regulated entities to report the address of persons making contributions. However, both states also separately require that the street names and street numbers either not be included on or be redacted from the version of filed reports that are made available online. The changes I propose would continue to uphold the Act's important transparency mission while also protecting individuals' personal safety. The public, including the press and other interested observers, would still have robust access to information about where money and politics is coming from by virtue of the contributors' names, city, state, zip code, and occupation and employer information. Members of the public who make contributions would avoid public disclosure of their street addresses that could, at unknown points in the future, put them and their families at risk. And by still collecting and transmitting full mailing address information to the commission, reporting committees in the commission would still be able to effectively track contributors to ensure compliance with relevant contribution limits. I look forward to working with Congress, my fellow commissioners, the regulated community, and the public in updating the Act and Commission regulations to amend the requirement that the Commission publish individual contributor street names and street numbers on public disclosure reports in a way that appropriately balances public transparency and the financing of federal campaigns with individual safety. In the interest of time, a longer written statement will be made available after the meeting on our website on my Commission page. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Lindebaum. Colleagues, any other comments, questions from Commissioner Dickerson? Commissioner Traynor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to thank Commissioner Dickerson for taking the laboring oar in bringing this issue forward and helping to generate the public comments that we've received. And I appreciate the comments that we have received and look forward to continuing to work with him and the rest of my colleagues on this particular issue. With regard to Commissioner Lindenbaum's comments on working on this particular issue and eliminating the address portion of the reports that are there, you know, I think it's important for both us and for Congress to look at the fact that many states already engage in the activity that she proposes, where that information is in fact reported to their state level entities, but is automatically redacted to only have the city and zip code of those individual donors. So I look forward to working on this with them. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Traynor. Colleagues, anything else?
Mr. Chairman?
Excuse me, Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also am not going to be able to support the directive, and I very much appreciate all of the comments that came in on fairly short notice. People put together some pretty compelling legal arguments and did some solid research for us. We appreciate you. Thank you. I think that some of the issues that are raised by this directive, and as pointed out by Commissioner Lindenbaum, are really questions that need to be addressed by Congress. Questions of how much information needs to be disclosed to the public, how it should be disclosed, and what thresholds are appropriate. These are questions that only Congress can answer. And I'm happy to work with my colleagues on legislative recommendations, and obviously happy to work with any member of Congress who is interested in amending the Act. In the meantime, we have the Act that we have. And it is fundamentally a disclosure act, and that is at the heart of our mission. I think there are a number of provisions in this directive that are either vague or are concerning to me. The idea that an organization acting on behalf of one or more of its contributors could seek to have its donor information either redacted or not disclosed in the first place would be a big departure from what the Commission has done before. The only time we've ever done that was in the Socialist Workers Party, a very small party involving very few donors. That was done after court decisions and after voluminous production of information documenting the harassment and threats that the organization members were facing. And we had a system where they had to ask every few years, first every 6 years, then every 4 years, for renewal of that. And every time they had to continue to produce evidence, solid evidence of the threats that they were facing. And the Commission approved those exemptions several times and then didn't. The Commission felt at a certain point that it couldn't be substantiated anymore based on the evidence that was in front of us. What this directive would do would allow a fast track procedure where our lawyers would be compelled to present immediately any request that was received. I don't know what immediately means. Is that within the hour, within the day, within the week? They're supposed to drop everything and put this in front of us. And in an interesting phrasing, it says it's supposed to be upon receipt of the application, the Office of General Counsel will immediately circulate the request and accompanying affidavit for approval on a 48-hour no objection ballot. Our 48-hour no objection ballots usually are for very uncontroversial issues that are presumed that they're going to get approved. We take more time and require affirmative votes for more serious issues. And I think that these are serious issues. And the notion that the council's office would immediately present this for approval is again a departure from the way we normally do business. This suggests to me, and maybe I'm misreading this, but I couldn't get a clear answer on it either in advance of this meeting. This suggests that the council's office is not would not do what they normally do, which is to do an analysis before and present a recommendation to the commission, but rather present the request in the context of an approval recommendation. There is only one possible, they're mandated to present it for approval. Now, what if the affidavit is defective? What if the affidavit says, has no factual basis? What if the affidavit claims that the person is going to be harassed by aliens who are going to abduct them if their address is made public? It seems to me that we should not assume that every affidavit will be well substantiated. And as I said, in the past, we've required more than a simple affidavit with a claim in it. And this has only happened, by the way, in the individual cases, a handful of times, really, I think in the history of the agency. It's very, very rare for the commission to provide that kind of exemption from disclosure. And I think that we have to take those requests seriously in terms of the threats that are alleged, but we also have to take them seriously in light of our fundamental duty to enforce the law and administer the law that requires this disclosure. And again, you know, until Congress changes it, which then we would have a different mission. I don't know whether it is feasible if an organization were to present a request that all of its donors not be redacted. This has a very short timeline. The request would have to be immediately presented on a 48-hour no objection ballot, and then the staff would have 5 business days to implement it. I don't even know if that's feasible. I don't know what the impact would be on our staff and on our budget, which is, as we all know, limited. So I think there are, and as courts have shown, and I appreciate some of the comments for pointing this out, courts that have considered analogous issues have not always upheld the request, have not always granted the requests of people who claimed they were going to be harassed, they were going to be threatened, and they needed an exemption from disclosure laws. Courts have sometimes said, sorry, that what the threats and harassment that you are suggesting are not enough to overcome the public interest in disclosure. So I think these are serious issues that require serious consideration and should not be put on a sort of grease the skids, fast track procedure that seems to assume that all of these requests would automatically be granted. So I think there are both issues of another issue with this directive is it doesn't provide any guidance on how the commission should go about making these decisions or what the standards would be for interpreting the words. I understand there are words in Supreme Court opinions, but words are subject to interpretation. And I think if we want to be transparent about this, we ought to provide more information about how we're going to make these decisions. And speaking of transparency, it was interesting to me that both the Campaign Legal Center and the Institute for Free Speech, two organizations that rarely agree on much, both agreed that the procedures described in this directive do not provide appropriate transparency to the public of what we would be doing and how these decisions would be made. And I think, again, for an agency that whose mission revolves around disclosure and transparency, that is that's a big problem. So as I said at the beginning, I'm not going to be able to support the directive, but I wanted to provide some of the reasons for that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair Commissioner Broussard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank all my colleagues for the comments that they've made today. I found them to be very helpful. Of course, we want to thank the public members that also submitted comments. This is an example of of the work that you do and send to us, we find very important. I will not be able to support the directive today, but the primary reason is that I am concerned about the agency's resources for enacting something like this. But enacting is the word that I think I want to focus on, is I do not believe that a directive is the appropriate means for us to be able to make this type of decision. I think that this at minimum should be a notice and comment so we can get some very healthy comments, more comments, but also possibly the legislative means that some of my colleagues have discussed. And I think it'd be worthy in that notice and comment period if we make it to that level to get some guidance in regards to that. So I say thank you for the efforts, but I will not be able to support it in this venue. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Broussard. Colleagues, anyone else want to seek comment? Commissioner Dickerson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me just endorse everything that Commissioner Lindenbaum said. I agree that this is a problem very much of Congress's making. I think unintentionally of Congress's making. And you know, the act was as she pointed out, I think we agree on a lot of the historical background, was drafted in a very different historical moment and probably does deserve consideration by our elected representatives. While we mere mortals scramble to do the best we can with the authorities that we have. So I would be happy to join her in the efforts that she described. In response to the Vice Chair, you know, I take all these points. It would have been, I would have welcomed any alternative draft directive while we were considering a regulation. None was forthcoming. So unfortunately, everyone's stuck with what I wrote. I do think it's a little unfair to characterize a no objection ballot as sort of tilting the hand just because, and I'm going to quote here from the directive, if any commissioner objects, the form shall be placed on the agenda for the next executive session of the commission where it would require four affirmative votes of the commission. And I took everything the vice chair to say as pretty good evidence that she would routinely object, thereby requiring four affirmative votes of the commission to move forward. So I think that at least that procedural objection is a well-trod one. With those comments, I'm happy to make a motion at an appropriate time, Mr. Chairman.
Does any other colleague want to seek recognition to say anything before we move to motions? Commissioner Dickerson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Some trepidation since I can read a room. I move the approval of agenda document number 24-19-A.
Thank you. Colleagues, any debate on Commissioner Dickerson's motion? All right, seeing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no.
No.
All right, that motion fails by a vote of 3-3. Myself, Commissioner Dickerson, Commissioner Traynor in favor, the Vice Chair, Commissioner Broussard, and Commissioner Lindenbaum opposed. Any additional motions? Commissioner Dickerson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do agree with Commissioner Broussard that this, you know, as I've mentioned, does require the formality of a rulemaking. I think that should have been done several decades ago, and I appreciate that I work with colleagues who are interested in carrying the load of doing that now. So to that effect, even without an temporary directive, I do think moving into a formal rulemaking is appropriate. And accordingly, I move that the Office of General Counsel be directed to draft within 75 days a notice of proposed rulemaking concerning requests to withhold, redact, or modify contributors and identifying information, and provide that draft to the Commission's Regulations Committee for further action.
Thank you, Commissioner Dickerson. Colleagues, any questions or debate on that motion?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am not going to be able to support the motion as crafted. I probably would have supported the motion if it didn't have the 75-day limit. I think that we have a regs committee for a reason, to help us set priorities. We have a lot of work to do. The regs committee has other items on its agenda. I don't know that 75 days is an appropriate amount of time to expect our staff to move other projects aside and start drafting this. But I do believe in processes, and we have a system set up for setting priorities for our rulemaking agenda, As I've said before, and as my colleagues frequently say, particularly in the enforcement context, we have limited resources. So I would be happy to support sending this to the Regs Committee to consider with it, along with their other agenda items, and to come up with a reasonable schedule for moving forward. But I cannot support the motion that says, you know, and you have to do it within a set number of days, because I think that steps on the prerogatives of the Regs Committee. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Commissioner Dickerson.
If it gives the Vice Chair any comfort, I did consult with the Regulations Committee before drafting this motion.
Colleagues, any other debate on the pending motion? Okay, seeing none, all of those in favor of Commissioner Dickerson's motion say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed?
I'm abstaining.
So I believe that vote was 5-0. Commissioner Broussard was in the affirmative. Is that right? Yes. So, okay, 5-0, myself, Commissioner Broussard, Commissioner Lindebaum, Commissioner Dickerson, and Commissioner Traynor in favor, and the vice chair abstaining. Anything else? No. Thank you very much to colleagues. We're going to move on to our second agenda item, which is the eligibility report of Mike Pence for president. We have Ms. Raminski and Ms. Patius from the audit division to present this item. So whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Chairman Cooksey and commissioners. Before you is the eligibility report for Mike Pence and the Mike Pence for President Committee, which circulated to the commission on May 13th, 2024. The audit division has certified that the eligibility requirements for receipt of the primary matching fund payments have been met and recommends that the commission determine that Mike Pence and Mike Pence for President have established eligibility to receive primary matching funds payments, send a notification letter to the Mike Pence for President Committee regarding the Commission's eligibility determination and advising on further matching funds requests, and send a notification to the Secretary of the Treasury of the candidate and committee's eligibility to receive payments from the Presidential Primary Matching Fund payment account and certify an initial payment of $100,000. We are available to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Raminski. Colleagues, any questions for the audit division about this eligibility document? Okay, seeing none, maybe an appropriate, Commissioner Traynor.
I don't have any questions, Mr. Chairman. If you were gonna move to motions, I was gonna make a motion.
Please go ahead.
Great, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I thought in doing this, I would give a little context for public disclosure. I've circulated to my colleagues here on the commission a motion for them to consider. And in moving to make that motion, it would make this an initial determination because I'm not sure right now sitting here that I'm fully satisfied that we're giving the right answer with this. If you look at 11 CFR 9033.5A1, upon which the OGC relies to make its recommendation, it speaks to not actively campaigning, but the contours of that standard are not really well defined. OGC's recommendation relies upon an older
matter. Commissioner Traynor, I'm really apologize to interrupt you, but I anticipate that I think what your motion is going to relate to is the next item on the agenda, which is the ineligibility document.
Oh, that's right. You're right. I'm sorry.
So the item we're discussing right now is the eligibility report from the audit division before we discuss the determination or the date of ineligibility.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. I apologize to my colleagues. So thank you.
No problem at all. I'm sorry to cut you off. So with respect to the eligibility report, the second item, are there any appropriate motions with respect to that?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With respect to the eligibility determination agenda document 24-20-A, I move approval of the audit division's recommendation.
Thank you very much. Is there any debate on the Vice Chair's motion with respect to the eligibility report? Okay, seeing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye.
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 That motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much to Ms. Raminski and Ms. Patius from the audit division. Now we're going to move on to the third and last substantive item, which is the Mike Pence and Mike Pence for President date of ineligibility, LRA 1194. And we have Mr. Bloom and Ms. Foreman here, and Ms. Selenkoff as well from the Office of General Counsel. And maybe before we open a discussion, if we could get a presentation about this document.
Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. Margaret Foreman.
Before the commission is the Office of General Counsel's memorandum recommending that the commission determine that Mr. Pence's date of ineligibility, that is the DOI, is October 28, 2023, the date that he publicly announced that he was suspending his campaign. ODC also recommends that the commission approve notification to Mr. Pence and that Pence for president of a DOI determination with an instruction to submit a statement of net outstanding campaign obligations, otherwise abbreviated as NOCO, within 15 calendar days of the DOI determination, and a notification that the portion of the $100,000 payment attributable to matched contributions that were received after the DOI may be used for only the limited purpose of defraying NOCO, plus estimated necessary winding down costs. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Horman. Colleagues, are there any questions for OGC on this report or discussion? Okay. Mr. Traynor, maybe if you could go back to the beginning.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So one of the struggles of doing this via Zoom is that if you miss things and you can't read the room, so I apologize for that. So as I was saying with regard to this particular recommendation, it relies upon an older matter, the Simon campaign, but we can't seem to locate the commission's legal analysis with regard to that Simon campaign matter. And then only yesterday, our counsel's office made us aware of another prior matter addressing the same issue here from the Sharpton campaign, but I haven't had enough time to look into that matter and undertake the necessary legal analysis. So my motion today will be to make this an initial determination and afford the Pence Committee an opportunity to respond to the recommendations made by our counsel's office and bring forth any other germane facts or legal arguments that they have. So with that, as I circulated to the commission, I would move that the commission reject OGC's recommendations, that we make an initial determination for the reasons set forth in OGC's memorandum that Mike Pence and Mike Pence for President's date of ineligibility under 26 USC 9033C and 11 CFR 90335A3 is in fact October 28, 2023, and direct OGC to provide the memo to Mike Pence and the Mike Pence for President, along with an appropriate letter explaining the commission's decision to treat the memo as an initial determination and inform Mike Pence and the Mike Pence for President campaign of their opportunity to respond pursuant to 11 CFR 9033.6.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Traynor. Colleagues, is there debate on Commissioner Traynor's motion or questions? Commissioner Dickerson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's not debate per se. I want to thank my colleagues. I'm going to invoke the proverbial duck, that the sort of classic creature on the surface and then the curious paddling underneath. There's been, closer observers will note that this memorandum is dated the 14th of May, which was 2 days ago. And there's been a lot of very sincere effort by a lot of people in the staff and my fellow commissioners to get us to a place where, despite the unusual circumstances, we're able to move forward. And that doesn't always get the credit it deserves. So I want to thank everyone.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Dickerson. Colleagues, anyone else? Questions or debate? Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was prepared to support OGC's recommendations, which I think are perfectly sound. This is a departure from our usual practice to provide this additional opportunity for comment. But as Commissioner Dickerson said, there's been a lot of work. There's been a flurry of activity in the last couple of days. And one of the things that our staff have assured us of, which is important to me, is that while it's unusual, it is not contradicted by the regulations. The regulations allow us to do this, although it is not the typical way that we would proceed at this point. I don't really know what he's going to say that's going to change the determination, given that he did announce that he was suspending his campaign. And I don't see how we could extend his eligibility beyond the point when he announced publicly that he was suspending his campaign. But I, with a a little bit of trepidation because, as I said, I don't like things that deviate from the normal process. I don't think it will do any harm. And if it gives my colleagues some comfort, you know, we can provide a little extra opportunity for comment. So I would have supported OGC's recommendation as is. I thought it was well-founded. I appreciate all of their hard work. But I will support my colleague's motion.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Anything else, colleague? Okay, seeing none, we have Commissioner Traynor pending motion, so I'll call the question. All those in favor of Commissioner Traynor's motion say aye.
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 All right, that motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much to the Office of General Counsel for that and for all the, I agree with Commissioner Dickerson, all the work that's been going into the last 48 hours. Before we close out, I want to end with a few acknowledgments. First, I'm a week late, but last week, not this week, was Public Service Recognition Week. So I want to take a moment publicly to acknowledge that, as we did here internally at the agency last week. For nearly 50 years, actually, I think our 50th anniversary is coming up at the end of this year, dedicated civil servants at the FEC have helped fulfill this agency's transparency mission for the American people. Our work rarely takes up the national spotlight, but it is critical to the proper functioning of our country's democratic system of government. And while ours may be a small agency of roughly 300 people compared to maybe, you know, tens of thousands who work at the Defense Department or more, hundreds of thousands, I think, I would say I don't think any other agency in the federal government, pound for pound, can match our staff's performance and their passion for the job. And so it's truly an honor to work with so many dedicated people at this agency. It makes a big difference, and I thank all of you. In that same vein, I want to recognize one person who maybe truly embodies public service, a dedication to public service, and that is our soon-to-be retiring colleague, Mr. Tony Buckley. This is Tony's last open meeting at the commission before his retirement at the end of this month, after 35 years of dedicated service at the commission. Tony began the commission in the enforcement division, right, 1989. I won't say where I was. After a long tenure in the enforcement division, Tony then has moved over to the policy division in 2002, where he has been working for the last 22 years, churning out consistent, high quality, high volume work for the commission. I've always been impressed with Tony's work, and also with his wisdom, his historical knowledge about the agency and our history. I know he has been a huge resource for his colleagues, including me, and it's a huge loss to our organization, but his retirement is very well earned, very well deserved. So Tony, we wish you all the best in your retirement, fair winds and following seas, and thank you very much. With that, Mr. Staff Director, are there any management or administrative items we need to discuss today?
Mr. Chairman, there are no such matters.
With that, we're going to stand adjourned. Thank you.